Hello, lovely listeners, and a happy new year to you all. And we're also continuing our psychological autopsy of John Meehan. So Dirty John and Deborah Newell. Now, many of you will recall we interviewed Christopher Goffard, the LA Times journalist who broke the Dirty John story and who created the podcast of the same title, which incidentally has been downloaded more than 30 million times. And we interviewed Chris in October 2017. While following our podcast, Deborah's friend reached out to me saying that Deborah wanted to meet me. She was curious as to how I understood what happened to her and wanted to learn more, and also that I gave it a name, and I gave it the name Coercive Control. And that first meeting has led me to working with Deborah and her daughters. Well, since that meeting, I've met many others involved in the case, including other victims, police officers, and the DA, Matt Murphy. I've been deep diving the case to understand the lessons so that we can educate society about the risks and dangers of coercive control and serial predatory perpetrators. You may also remember that in our initial three episodes, we analysed the phone calls between John Meehan and his first wife, Tonya Bells, who had two children with him. Well, Tonya also reached out to me on social media and wanted to have a further discussion and meeting, and I had the pleasure of meeting her. She's an incredible woman who was married to him for 10 years, and she wants to ensure that the lessons are also learned, and perhaps she knew him the best. Now, if you haven't listened to those previous episodes, please do. And since our episodes, you'll also know that there has been a scripted Bravo show with Connie Britton playing Deborah Newell and Eric Bana playing John Meehan. And the season finale was on Sunday. Well, on Monday the 14th of January, there was the two-hour Oxygen documentary, Dirty John, The Dirty Truth. Now, if you haven't checked either of those shows out, I would strongly recommend that you do. And you may see some very familiar faces in the two-hour documentary that aired on Oxygen. I also want to lastly add that there have been so many women who have come forward as a result of Deborah and Tonya sharing their stories. It's so powerful and empowering for others, and it's really brave of Deborah to put her life on display and under the microscope. And I just want to acknowledge that. If you are being abused, you are not alone. You do not have to suffer in silence. And we know that it's so much more than just physical abuse. It's also coercive controlling behaviour and psychological abuse. And that's the part that resonates much more with victims. And the fact that I just want to underline is that abuse can happen to anyone. And it really does. And I say that because I've recently been on the Dirty John official Facebook page and I've seen so much judgment and assumptions and victim blaming going on. So it really underlines and highlights to me that we still have such a long way to go. And Deborah and I are fully engaged and up for the challenge to educate society and raise awareness about the risks and dangers of coercive control and change the law here in the US. I've already been part of changing the law, spearheading law reform in the UK. Ireland have just changed the law on coercive control. These are, after all, the most dangerous of cases. And we mustn't forget, separation is the most dangerous time for women leaving an abuser. In fact, 76% of women were murdered on the point of separation. It's the reason why many stay, because they know it is just too dangerous to leave. So if somebody discloses abuse to you and you ask the question, why don't you leave? Understand that they may be staying because it's keeping them alive. And you have to plan your exit very carefully and very safely with advocates and those who are specialists in this area. 94% of murders have coercive control and stalking behaviour prior to the homicide. Two women are murdered every week in the UK and one every 16 hours in the US. Please educate yourself. It could be your daughter, it could be your sister, it could be your friend, your family member, it could be you. We must do more to protect women and take them seriously when they disclose and report. The helpline numbers are at the end of this episode, and just to say, some may find the content triggering. Please do reach out for support and advice if you need it. And I've added a section on my website with more information about coercive control, the behaviours and how to spot the warning signs. Just go to laurarichards.co.uk/coercive control. Now, without further ado, here's our interview with the brave and courageous Tonya Bells.
Did he tell you much about this guy?
Yes.
Like what?
He told me to, well, he put a picture of the guy on our refrigerator so that every morning when I, every time I went to the refrigerator, I'd see him. And he said that if you ever see this man anywhere at home or when you're out, you call the police.
And you knew he was going after him.
I knew that there were strange things happening, but it wasn't until I listened to the podcast that I realized how dangerous this man was and that, you know, he was protecting me. I don't even know if Dennis knew that this guy could, you know, it was go after the family, go after the loved ones.
Go after you.
Hi, lovely listeners, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioural analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service. And with me today in the studio is...
Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, and we're missing somebody from the team today.
We are. Mr. Jim Clementi, unfortunately, couldn't be with us today, which we're very sad about, but we do have a very special guest who's joining us live from Atlanta, and our special guest is...
Hi, I'm Tanya Bales. I am the infamous first wife of John, Dirty John Meehan.
Dirty, filthy John Meehan.
Correct.
And we are so happy to have you joining us, Tanya. Thank you so much for sharing your story, because we've heard a lot about... sadly, Dirty John, but as we're Real Crime Profile, we like to talk with and share and honour the survivors. And certainly, you know, from a victim perspective, we like to highlight and raise awareness, and certainly the learning in all cases is really important for Real Crime Profile. And you've gone through an incredible experience, and I know you feel very strongly about helping other women who may be in a situation that you experienced, or maybe even in terms of future, if someone finds themselves in a situation, then we would like to highlight some of the things that you can do. And I've always called these cases murder in slow motion. You know, when there's coercive control, when there's stalking. And we want to make sure, because you have daughters too, you understood the risks to Emily and Abigail. And in our, did we do three episodes, Lisa? Three or four episodes?
With Chris Gofford. And then on our own to analyze, all the dynamics.
We did. And we listened to the phone calls that you had with John. And you were probably one of the very few people who really understood that he was a risk and you knew that it would end badly.
That's correct. I didn't know how it would end, but I knew this was going to go up in a big ball of fire someday.
So before we get to the end, let's start at the beginning. And, you know, perhaps you can tell us and our listeners, how did you and John meet and when did you meet?
Well, I met John when I was a nurse working 3 to 11 in surgery. And we used to go out, all of us were single, and we'd go out dancing after work to blow off some steam. And I met John on an evening at a local dance club, bar, whatever you want to call it. On a night, I didn't even really want to go to that particular place, and I kind of fought against it, but we ended up there. And just on a simple trip to the bathroom, him and his friend stopped me and asked me where I worked or what I did for a living. And I politely stopped and talked to him and answered his question. And that's how it started.
Where was this?
That was in Dayton, Ohio.
Dayton, Ohio. Okay.
So he stopped you. That's a very interesting point, that he... no doubt being, and now we understand more about him psychologically, but he was probably scanning the room and it was he who came up to you and initiated the conversation, right?
Yeah, I believe that to be true now, yes.
And so what happened from there on out? How did the conversation go?
Well, he was very, you know, kind of bubbly and engaging and charming. And we started talking about medicine because he was working, I think, as in like the cath lab or something. And he was going to law school at a private Catholic university. So I thought, well, he's, you know, super smart guy and he's Catholic and I'm Catholic. And we had, you know, pretty good conversation. There was a red flag kind of right away, but I didn't necessarily see it as that. He got out his driver's license to order a drink, and I kind of snatched it away in fun. and it had an age on it because we had discussed our ages already, and it hit the age on his driver's license didn't match what he had said. And I said, you know, I thought you said you were 20, he would have been 24 at the time. I thought you said you were 24. And he said, oh, I changed my driver's license a long time ago, you know, in high school to be able to buy alcohol. He's like, I got to get that fixed. And I was like, oh, I know lots of people that have done that.
Sounds kind of plausible, doesn't
it? So what age did it say on the license? What?
So I think it was his actual birth date on the license, which he was born in 59, but I thought he was born in 1964. So he was telling me he was only 1 year older than me, when in fact he was, 6 years older than me.
Right. So you were what? You were 25 at the time.
I was 23 when I met him.
So 23 when you met him, and then you were married for 10 years. So it was 12 years total, the relationship?
Right. We got married at 25. I was 25 and I thought he was 26, but he would have been 31.
So tell us a little bit about what happened after that first meeting. How did the relationship sort of take shape?
Well, honestly, I thought he was really nice that first evening, but I didn't really actually think I was going to be that interested. He asked me to dance and I thought, okay, I'll dance with him and this will be the end of it, you know. But he knew where I worked. And so the very next day he had me paged in the operating room.
Wow.
Whoa. Where I worked, yes. Yeah, so he didn't have my number, but he knew where I worked.
Pretty bold to do that.
So, yeah. So, you know, it's 1988, so I was paged overhead. We didn't have cell phones or I didn't have a pager as a nurse. So I got called to the hall phone and I answered it. And, you know, he was very sweet and charming and, you know, complimented me and that he'd like to see me again. And, you know, would I see him? And so I offered him a date.
Did that embarrass you? Did it mortify you when he did that? Or were you flattered? And was it like, oh, man?
Yeah, flattered. Yeah.
And that's always the challenge with these things. You know, is it romantic? Is it somebody who, you know, is just showing real interest, that he's attentive and he understands where you work? Or is it someone who's trying to move the dial, you know, very quickly? And those things are quite difficult to discern from early on, and particularly if you like someone. I mean, you always said that you were quite cautious from the start, but there he is sort of flattering you and he's being very complimentary, which obviously made you feel good.
Right. And I wasn't someone who had ever been picked up anywhere. So I just didn't have any experience with that. And I was, you know, I just was polite to even stop and answer his question. To me now, it kind of seems like, why would I stop and tell a stranger where I work, like the first thing out of my mouth? I mean, that seems kind of stupid now.
You're at a bar. No, that's what you're there for, is to socialize and to get to know people. And
but I always went with a group of friends and we really kind of just stuck to each other. It was girls and guy friends. And we usually went together, danced and left together. That was kind of our routine. So it was kind of an unusual.
Yeah. And he'd asked you for a lift home, hadn't he? Or somehow you ended up giving him a lift home.
Yeah. So his friend said, you know, that he wanted to leave and that was John's ride. And, you know, he said, you know, will you give me a ride home? And I said, no. And, you know, he kind of, you know, pressed me, you know, please, no, I want to stay a little bit longer and, you know, talk to you or whatever. And I'm like, well, where do you live? And he lived the opposite direction of me. And again, I did not want to give him a ride home, but I was polite. And I didn't really know how to say no to that, even though I was mad at myself for agreeing to do it, going in the opposite direction.
A lot of women do that.
So I did give him a ride home.
Yeah. Not pushing
that, totally out of character for me. Yeah. My friends were very surprised.
Pushing the boundaries. And, you know, it talks to his skills and his ability to get what he wants, you know, to manipulate people. And of course, we see that across a lot of his relationships where he would be able to sort of tell women exactly what they wanted to hear and make them fall in love with him. Mm-hmm. So how did the relationship then continue?
You know, I then saw him almost every evening after that, you know. So we just started dating and, you know, getting to know each other. And he asked me a lot of questions about myself and my family. And a lot of the answers that I gave were things that seemed to mesh with what he wanted you know, out of life, you know, that he was also Catholic and wanted to have a family and have children and all of those things that you talk about in the very beginning. We're both, you know, intelligent, getting our advanced degrees, and we seem to have a lot in common that way.
Was he really going to law school, and was he really Catholic?
He was really Catholic, and he was really going to law school.
But he failed at law school. He didn't complete, right?
Yeah, so after a year of dating, and by then we are engaged. It's a little over a year. And he called me. He had gone to L.A. to work at a law firm that his dad hooked him up with, supposedly. And when he came back from Christmas break, he called me, and he seemed very distraught. And he told me that the bank had lost his loan application for school, and he had 3 days to have 50% of his tuition, or they were going to drop his classes. And he was genuinely upset. So I don't know if that's when he found out that he had not passed that semester, but I believed he just needed money. And I didn't have any money because I was in anesthesia school, and we were engaged, and I did, you know, go to my parents and say, this is the situation. And my parents said, well, I don't think we're going to do that, you know. And so they didn't. And John left Ohio and went to California to work as the law clerk and go to night school. And I believe it's called Western State, maybe. I don't know. So I believed he was in law school in California, but I don't have any confirmation of that.
Did your parents like him? Did they, what were they bowled over by him too? Or what was their reaction to him?
I mean, I can't tell you necessarily their first reaction, but I think my parents trusted me. I've always been kind of a know what I want kind of girl and very independent. And my parents weren't a lot in my business, and they didn't really need to be because I was a good girl and a good kid. So I think they just thought that if I loved him and I checked him out, then he must be okay. And so, yeah, my mom, you know, loved him like a son and treated him like a son. My mom doesn't have any sons. So, yeah.
So now you're in different states and he's studying and you are too. So you have a long distance relationship.
Yes, a long distance relationship. And he is writing me love letters almost every day, like pen pal love letters. Snail mail, which is
the old fashioned kind, right?
Yes. And he's talking about, you know, our future together and, you know, getting married and, you know, how wonderful everything's going to be.
And you had phone calls as well as letters?
Absolutely had phone calls. Yeah. But on top of those phone calls, I mean, to get a love letter in the mail every day, every other day was, you know, pretty impressive, you know, and I think he was working as a law clerk and maybe not doing much there, instead writing me letters. I don't know.
Trying to get you to fall in love with him, which it sounds like, you know, he was successful at.
Well, because long distance relationships are just notoriously difficult. So he wants you on that chain. He wants you to not, you know, disengage with him to meet somebody else. Would you say, Laura, that he's trying to keep her where he wants her?
It wasn't a chance. I'm a very loyal person. That wouldn't have been on his radar. Oh. And therefore, it wasn't on mine either.
And so how soon was he talking about marriage or, you know, you getting engaged?
I mean, as I recall, maybe within the first 6 months. I don't think it was any sooner than that.
So say a little bit what happened with the proposal and the ring.
Okay, so I knew that he had purchased a diamond. I saw it, like a free diamond, and he asked me what kind of setting I wanted, and I had a little bit of input into that. And he just came to my apartment and just the two of us together. And it wasn't anything, you know, super great like you see today, or super set up, just a very personal, you know, intimate, you know, request for marriage that I wasn't surprised by. I did later find out that the ring was not real. The center stone was a fake diamond. And I found that out because one of the smaller stones had fallen out of the ring, and I took it to a jeweler. And he looked at it under one of those little monocle things or whatever. And he said, you know, this isn't real. And the blood drained out of my face. I mean, I just felt it. And I lied and said that I did, because how humiliating that I didn't know that. So I pretended that I did know and left with the ring and didn't, you know, get that other stone, you know, repaired. But I told John then that I'd lost that little stone. And he said, oh, you know, I'll take care of that. I'll get that fixed for you. He said, I've always wanted to get you a nicer diamond than the one I bought you. You know, that wasn't a very expensive one. I'd like to get you a better one. And I thought, oh, you know, he just really wanted to please me with a nice ring that he couldn't afford when we got married. How sweet is that? And now he wants to get a real one. I'm not going to embarrass him by telling him that I know. Mm-hmm. And that's how that went.
Yeah. I mean, these are very clever tools and tactics, really. You know, he's kind of covering off bases, but does it in a way that you initially feel the shame and the humiliation, but then you don't want to embarrass that person. He kind of flips it again. And that flipping the script is something that he became very adept at throughout the relationships.
On a maybe selfish level, it validated what I had been through. It's not something that in casual conversation, if someone asks you about it, you can adequately describe the story in less than 5 hours.
And did you meet his family? Did you get to know his family at all?
So before our marriage, I did meet his father very briefly. He told me that his parents were not good people, that his dad was an alcoholic, that his mom was a pill popper, that they were divorced. It was a terrible divorce. And that his parents are very, you know, selfish people that didn't get along. And that's why he didn't want to invite them to our wedding, because he said that, he didn't want to embarrass me, embarrass my family, who's, you know, paying for this very expensive wedding and such. But so I did go to California before we got married, and I met his dad just very briefly. We were there when his dad got home from work, and John said, you watch, first thing he'll do when he comes home is, you know, make himself a drink. And that's exactly what his dad did. So he's, you know, I'm getting confirmation of the things that he said, you know. And his dad wanted us to go out to dinner with him. And John said, we're not going out to dinner with my dad. He's like, the last time I went out to dinner with him, he got sloppy drunk and he was, you know, flirting with the waitress. And, you know, he got caught up on the tablecloth and the whole table spilled all over the floor. And I'm just not going to, you know, put you through that. So we're going to make an excuse as to, you know, why we can't go to dinner with him. So I thought, well, that's very, you know, kind of you. I don't want to be in that kind of situation, you know? So, and I met his sister, I think twice, also very briefly. Like, these are like 15 minute in and out type of things, you know, where there's not long enough to have a conversation about anything real, just like an introduction and a meeting.
But let's go back to the wedding, because obviously it's portrayed, the wedding on the Bravo show, and we talked about it on the podcast. And so the wedding takes place November 1990, and was it you taking the video where you're sort of, you know, you've got the camera and you're asking some of his friends about him?
No. That was another one of the groomsmen. I didn't know about any of those conversations until the wedding video was, you know, edited and came back to me. Right. So that was just all the guys together, you know, going around interviewing people.
Right. So the actual wedding day itself, though, can you say a bit about that? And then we'll talk about the video and just what you learned afterwards when you were watching the video.
Well, the wedding day went without a hitch, as far as I could see as the bride.
I mean, you looked beautiful. He really looked the part. It was a beautiful wedding.
Yes, and a matter of fact, in the limousine, he presented me with a diamond tennis bracelet. I had borrowed like a fake bracelet from somebody, and he had it all planned out in the limo afterwards. He said, let me see that bracelet you borrowed, and I held it up or whatever. I'm like, oh, this is just, you know, something, you know, simple. And he said, I think this one would look better, and he gave me a real diamond tennis bracelet, you know. So I thought that was fabulous. And I showed that to all the guests at the wedding. And
you're sure it's real now?
Yeah, right?
Yes, because I sold it. It's real. Yeah. Oh, I had it tested right away after we split. I'm like, I got to see if this is real. Yeah.
So then you watch the video, and actually there were a couple of interesting points, because that's where it's revealed in the podcast, the LA Times and Wondery podcast, that, you know, the guys, and they all look slightly sheepish about it, but some of them look fairly smug, saying, you know, he's known as Dirty John or Filthy John. But then there's two other men who say, he's also called the Cruiser, you know, which I took to mean that he was kind of cruising, you know, nightclubs or places looking for women. And then there was another man who said, "Run, Tonya," and sort of, you know, yelled. And it may have been taken as a joke, but there were three interesting sort of points that
were
made.
So I think you're referring, some of those are from the Bravo TV show, not my actual wedding video. When the guy yells "run," I don't think that's not in my real video, is it?
I don't know, but that's what I'm asking you. Were those three things said?
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, just the comment about calling him Filthy John. And I did ask him about that. I said, "John, what are they talking about? Why are they calling you that?" And he's like, "Tonya, they're drunk. It doesn't mean anything." He says, "I don't know what they're talking about."
Did you know these guys well? Did you hang out with these guys?
No. So because I was living in Cincinnati in anesthesia school, John's living in Dayton, and we didn't hang out with his friends very much. And then, of course, the second year, he's in California, so I never saw those guys again after my wedding.
Interesting. So you never really got to know his friends or people around him?
Anyone that knew him.
No, and if you, yeah, that's what I was thinking, that if she...
Because he's come from California, no one knows him, so he's only who he says he is to everyone.
I feel like in the podcast, like, they really didn't know him either.
Right, and it does seem so strange to me now, like the best man says, "I've known John, you know, 3 or 4 years now." I mean, most best men will say, "I've known him since we were children," or, "I've known him for a decade," or whatever. 3 or 4 years is nothing, you know?
Yeah. So the Bravo show changed it a little bit and added more to that, to what was said. And of course, you know, I've looked at other wedding videos where sadly it's ended up in a murder and where the groom has had no one there, not one family member, not one friend. And, you know, again, how it can be characterized is exactly what John and some of these individuals have said. Well, you know, they're toxic. My family are bad news. And therefore, people don't necessarily see it as a warning sign. But I would always say, you know, to do your due diligence and to ask those questions when people only have, you know, friends of a year or 2 years. And it's interesting that you said now when you look back, you know, it's a question mark when the best man said the three or four years that he'd known him for. But also just the double standard. And I'm always interested to hear, you know, when men kind of say someone sleeps around or they've got X notches on the bedpost, that it's seen as, you know, they're a stud, etc. And it's just steeped in kind of misogyny when you hear that bragging, those bragging rights, you know, whereas for a female, it's seen as a very negative thing. Right. And so even him being called Dirty John or Filthy John, they're kind of reinforcing it's okay to behave in that way.
Almost like they admired that part, like they were jealous of that part. Yeah.
And I think that's part of our society now. You know, it's something that we talk about with, you know, casual sexism and just how things are seen differently for boys, for men, for girls and for women. But, it, you know, it's just a point of note that there's a real double standard there. So the wedding takes place. Is there any change in the relationship once you're married or anything different between you and John, or does
well,
he behave
the first
the same
three, no, not really. The first 3 months, we lived apart because I was still in school. And so we got married in November, and I didn't move to California until the beginning of February. And I initially moved in with him, with John, who was living with his boss. So John was renting a room from his boss, and I moved in there till we found our own place.
You had to move all the way out there, leaving your family, your friends, to go be with him out there.
Right, because he's in law school. He's working as a law clerk and going to law school. So I went out there, yeah. And I would just say that it was a very difficult transition for me. One, because John's working full time. He's supposedly going to school at night, a couple nights a week. He's also an avid pickup basketball player and would play basketball 2-3 nights a week. And so I felt very alone. And I'm starting a brand new career as a nurse anesthetist, which is, you know, one of the most stressful jobs you can have, especially in the very beginning. And I felt a little bit isolated. Now, he came home every night. You know, it's not like he wasn't, you know, he's sleeping out or something. He was always home. And I always felt loved and, you know, that he showed me plenty of attention when he was around, but he just wasn't around a lot because of those things.
Right. And so for you, it's quite isolating, leaving everything you know and all your networks, and here you are, you know, starting afresh, starting again.
Right. So it didn't last very long in California. He saw that I was not very happy. And so he, at one point, you know, he suggested maybe we should go back to Ohio. He said that the law school he was going to was not an ABA approved school, so that he would have to practice in California for like the first 5 years. I don't know if any of that's true or not. And that he thought maybe California wasn't a great place to raise a family. So he said, let's move back to Ohio and I'll go reapply to the University of Dayton Law School. So he went back to Ohio before we moved back and supposedly had a conversation with them. And we did move back, and the law school told him that he couldn't start school for another year. And that seemed to freak him out, that he, you know, wouldn't be able to start for a whole year. What was he going to do, type of thing? I wasn't too worried about it because I could support us, you know. But that's when he said, you know, I think I don't think I want to be a lawyer anymore. I think I want to be a nurse anesthetist. And I was like, what? You have a year and a half left of school and you want to go back 2 more years to nursing and over 2 years to become a nurse anesthetist? He's like, but I just don't think I'll be happy. So, I mean, what can I say? Well, yes, you will be happy. You're going to finish law school. No, I didn't say that. I said, okay, I'll support you and we'll get through that.
Well, we've known for a long time. This is all new to you guys, but we've been watching him and watching his story and kind of keeping an ear and an eye open with a detective in Ohio for the last 17, 18 years. So some of it's a surprise. Exactly how it happened was a surprise, but we knew that this was going to end in someone dying. We just didn't know who.
And he wasn't taking, was he taking drugs at this time? Or do we know, did he...
I don't suspect so. I didn't suspect so, but I never suspected anything until the very, very end when I was finding evidence. So, you know, even as the Bravo TV show shows him like running, you know, running into walls and falling asleep doing the dishes, those things never happened. I never had those signs. I did think that he fell asleep very quickly, but I also thought he was very tired and working very hard. But that's the only red flag I had, was that, you know, he just fell asleep. And he would sometimes go upstairs so I wouldn't be around necessarily when he, you know, when he fell asleep. I'd go up and see what he's doing. He's like, he's passed out. And that was the only thing.
Which, as you say, could be just down to the fact you're both working hard. He's working hard. And therefore, that can be explained away as well. But so
12-hour nights, and we have 2 little kids, and yeah.
And how was he when you said you were expecting? Was he happy? Was he nervous? Was he jealous? Like, what was that reaction?
When I was expecting a baby?
Yep.
Yeah. So the first baby, he was very excited about. I mean, that was planned. He did want to wait a little bit longer than me, and that was planned. And he seemed, you know, overjoyed by, you know, having a little girl, and seemed to bond with her very well. By the time we're having the second child, he's already started a relationship with a woman in another state who is a physician. And I started to feel a disconnect. But even before that, we planned to have the second child when he finished anesthesia school. And it was something that struck me very odd when I did the pregnancy test and I told him, you know, that I was pregnant, which was planned. he said, congratulations.
Congratulations.
Yeah, like it didn't feel like a joint, you know,
like
an our baby. It felt like a your baby.
Yeah, right, thing. Right.
It just struck me just a little, you know, strange at the time, more so now, of course, because he was already out of the relationship. He was already telling, you know, another woman that he was getting divorced, and that's how he struck up that relationship with her. He overheard a conversation she was having in the doctor's lounge with a girlfriend. She was saying that she was, you know, sad that she'd broken up with her boyfriend, and he approached her and said that, you know, not that I'm over, you know, listening to your conversation, but I know what you're going through. I'm going through a divorce right now. And not only did he say he was going through a divorce right now, he said that I was pregnant with another man's baby, and he was embarrassed at work. Because everybody knew that I had cheated on him and was pregnant with someone else's child. So that Yeah.
So what does that mean? Like, why does he have to gild that tarnish that lily with that kind of? He doesn't have to say that. I mean,
well, because it gets instant rapport. He's empathizing with her, saying, I know you're going through a difficult time, so too am I. He's using a sort of a shame situation to make her now feel sorry for him. It's actually very clever, because in a number of very short sentences, he's got her on side with him. And, right. Of course, now he becomes the victim, you become the bad person, and she will empathize with him, and the rapport will be there, the connection. So it's a very it's a shortcut into, you know, it's like a hack into somebody's rapport and liking.
And it's kind of the same thing he did to me with his family, although he was talking about how bad his parents were. He's now talking to this woman how bad his wife was. And she thought, oh, my God, you're working, you know, in two different states to support your family and your wife has done this to you. How awful, you know, so she felt bad for him, and he's so believable that she believed it.
And it's tapping into raw emotion, not just being complimentary of using something that's kind of like, you know, cheesy or one-dimensional in terms of a compliment. It's tapping into someone's vulnerability, mirroring it and raising it. So bringing something far bigger and greater to the table. And that's how he started that relationship, was it? They began a relationship thereafter.
And because in her defense, who would say that unless it was real?
Right.
But some women would react to that like, oh, my God, this guy's a hot mess. I'm not going near this guy. He's got so much drama, you know. So he must have internally sensed that this woman would respond to it and not push away.
Psychopaths are very good at judging the situation. He judged her vulnerability. He probably had been listening for a little while. Even that initial, you know, I haven't been over listening. Well, you have, because otherwise you wouldn't know what's being shared between two women. But he can tap into it, and he can, it's like a laser focus, being able to identify, you know, not you, not you, not you, but you. And yes, I'm sure there were times where some women probably did say, you know, get lost, I'm not interested. But it's also a numbers game. And I still think if you tap into vulnerability, someone's raw vulnerability, it's very rare when someone's feeling in a vulnerable state that they would then lash out at somebody else who's sharing, you know, a vulnerability too.
So then what happened?
So now he has her on side. They have a relationship and they have a child, don't they, together at some point?
They do. But that was after. So I don't know anything about this relationship with the woman for over a year. And but I'm starting to feel a disconnect, you know, even when I was pregnant with Abigail. Abigail was born then the following September, so almost a year after they, you know, started dating. And I'm feeling a disconnect. And that Christmas, so Abby's only 3 months old, that Christmas, John is working in this other state, and he tells me he's going to be home at, you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I think, oh, good, he'll be home at one. He can watch the kids. I'm going to run out and get his Christmas present. He wanted to learn to fly planes, so I was going to buy him this little starter kit of how to fly planes. And I thought, well, you know, he'll be home at one. That'll be enough time.
By the way, sorry to interrupt, but what's a little starter kit?
It was some sort of $150, like the introduction to flying class.
The class.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it was like for the class. And so, you know, 2 o'clock rolls around, 3 o'clock rolls around, 4 o'clock rolls around. I don't know if I called him or not, or whether he, you know, didn't answer his phone. But when he walked in the door at 4 or 5 o'clock, and by then it's too late for me to go because it's Christmas Eve and the place closed, I approached him at the door and I said, you know, is your phone broken? And he got nasty with me kind of right away. And I said, you knew 4 hours ago that you weren't going to be home in time. You know, why didn't you give me the courtesy of a phone call? I was going to go get your, you know, Christmas present. And he just kind of turned on me at that moment. And in hindsight, I think he used that as his out, that he used that against me, that I was too controlling. He didn't need a mother telling him what time to come home. And he said, we're going to talk. We need to have a talk after Christmas. And I thought, okay, why can't we have a talk now? We are talking now.
Did he just deflect it?
Yeah, he just deflected it. And then, so we did end up, I kind of had to push the talk. We were getting more and more disconnected over the next couple of weeks. And so I kind of pushed him, you know, to have the talk, you know, when are we going to talk, you know? And So that's when he tells me, you know, you're too controlling. I don't need another mother and I'm not happy. And I said, well, we're going to go to counseling, right? I mean, we just had a baby and, you know, and of course, then I start thinking, okay, well, maybe I am too controlling. And, you know, maybe I shouldn't have done that or whatever. So I start counseling by myself. I go to the first one by myself and I'm telling her, you know, the different things and what's going on. And I think I met with her twice and she said, well, you know, we need to bring John in here so he doesn't think that we're, you know, having this relationship that he's, you know, not been included in. So John comes in for his first visit and he starts explaining how I'm, you know, mothering him and he doesn't like that and he doesn't need that. And the counselor, she figured him out like in 10 seconds. She's like, you know, she's not acting like your mother. She's acting like, you know, a concerned wife who sees that your behaviors might be consistent with someone who's stepping outside the marriage. Right. So of course, John didn't like her. He only went one time and he said, I'm not going back to that fat lesbian anymore and we'll find somebody else.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, okay, you find somebody, you know? So he said he would. And then weeks passed and he didn't find anybody. And then we did eventually seek another counselor. And during that time, he goes on a short trip to the University of Arizona, which he seemed to have, a love for his time there. I don't know. But he said he wanted to go and visit some of his professors, which he had done before. And when he came back from that trip, he left his suitcase unpacked in the bedroom floor for several days. And I was doing the laundry and I was kind of tired of looking at that suitcase. And I said, well, I'm going to unpack the suitcase and do the laundry. And in that suitcase, I find a syringe in a little plastic bag. And that syringe was empty, but it was wet. So as a nurse anesthetist, I know that there's been something in that syringe.
Right.
And I thought it very strange. So I unpacked everything and I kept the syringe, again, my vanity. And I started to confide in an anesthesiologist that he was working with in the other state, who was someone that I did know. And I told him, he said, send me the syringe. I'll have it tested. So I sent that syringe to him and he took it to the lab and it tested positive for both opiates, narcotics, and benzodiazepines, which would be Versed or Valium type drugs. So now I know that, but that's all I know.
And why does he have to take it in the vein? Why can't he take over-the-counter stuff or is that?
Well, he could, but as nurse anesthetists, we have access to the most purest sterile forms of drugs. And you know exactly what it is. And he would have had the arrogance to think that he could, you know, take that, cipher some off the top and use it safely.
Which is
a bad road to go down.
Sure. But he left it there for you to find. Yeah, do you think that was arrogance or a mistake or?
Yeah. So, I mean, part of me is thinking, well, if he was doing something, he wouldn't have left it there. I mean, I would think you would want to hide that, you know, from your wife. But, you know, over the next, you know, that spring, in May, then I get divorce papers in the mail. And, well, they weren't addressed to me. They were addressed to him, but attorney's name was on the envelope. And just like Deborah, I opened that envelope.
But you'd had no discussion about it? You just, these appear in the mail?
Right. He was in Michigan when that came. And I think I know what this is, you know, because it was legal size and I opened it. I didn't care whether it had his name on it or not. I opened it. It was divorce papers and I was just sick. And so I tried to, you know, page him, call him. And actually I got hold of the anesthesiologist that had given him the work up there and told him. And of course he knew about the affair because he's right there watching it, but he was only learning about our marriage through John. He didn't know that I was unsuspecting and that things were in my mind okay. And so he actually then became kind of an informant and you know, turned in his guy card to help me. So at some point, you know, I start confiding in my sister and her husband, and they're like, you know, we just don't understand. Why is John leaving you? And this something's missing. You know, there's a puzzle piece missing here. And, you know, my brother-in-law, I think, said, you know, maybe we should find his family. And And so they found his mom's phone number. And one day I just picked up the phone and with my knees knocking, I called her. Not exactly like on the TV show either, but I called her and I said, is this Dolores? And she said, yes. And I said, you know, this is Tanya. I'm married to your son, John. Long pause. And she said, oh, Tanya, I knew you would call me one day. And I thought, okay. So in that phone conversation, I told her that, you know, your son's leaving me and I don't really understand. And, you know, there are some red flags here. And, you know, is there anything, you know, you could, you know, enlighten me with? And in that phone conversation, she told me that he'd been arrested for trafficking cocaine. And as it turns out, he turned state's evidence not only against his very best friend, but also the Mexican mafia, as I just learned this year.
When had that happened? When?
Like 80, 81, 82. I'm not exactly sure of the date because
before he met you.
Long before
he met you. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Before he went to the University of Arizona. So 81, 82. And he graduated college, so I think 88.
And the reason why he had no best friend at your wedding.
Right. Right. And I think maybe the reason he changed his name and changed his age was to, you know, hide from this best friend that he got into a lot of trouble, or maybe hide from this Mexican mafia that he, you know, led into a sting operation. I don't know 100% for sure. But of course, she told me that. And she said, you should talk to his sisters. And oh, by the way, he's mailing narcotics to his older brother, Dan. And we've told him to stop. And, you know, Dan's wife is very upset about it. And Dan was known to have a drug problem already without John mailing him, you know, some of the strongest narcotics out there. And so I talked to both of John's sisters. They corroborated everything that the mother had said and told me. And eventually John came to know that I called his mom, and he was not happy about it.
So this has been a fascinating conversation. And Tanya, I've met you many times, but I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours. Mm-hmm. There's so much to your story. You know, you knew him the longest, and to the other women who also hold up a mirror to him. And there's still more to come, because it's not just a case of a 6-hour podcast and that tells a story. Even the Bravo scripted show, the documentary, we're still learning things. So we appreciate you taking the time to share other details with us. And for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing off. If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.